Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Our first story today is we're going to be speaking a little bit about the Patriotic Alliance, where the party stands, where it fits into the tapestry of South African politics, and where it's heading in the next local government election. So this is prompted by a Daily Maverick piece called Gayton McKenzie's Trump Card. Populism winning the day for the Patriotic Alliance. And they, in the graphic they did for this, Trump is in an American flag, a not so subtle allusion to the US president. But, you know, I'm just going to draw from this piece and some of my own observations of the Patriotic Alliance. In a recent Facebook post, which seems to be how Gayton McKenzie, the leader of the Patriotic Alliance, tends to communicate with his party and his supporters. He said the next local government election is, quote, the most important for the party, and that the PA is, quote, the party to fear. The PA has recently won a number of by-elections around the country. This is something they've proved particularly good at. They've won some seats in Drakenstein and Mossel Bay in the Western Cape. On the edge of Soweto, they managed to win a seat from the ANC. The party has grown significantly since it was originally formed. People forget that the PA was actually formed in the 2014 election when it only got 0.07% of the vote and got absolutely nowhere. However, that sort of turned around in 2020 when Nathaniel Julius, a 16-year-old teenager, was killed by the police in Eldorado Park. And this was an issue that was really seized upon by the PA to kind of highlight the issues facing particularly colored youth in South Africa. And from there, they've steadily grown. They won 75 seats across the country, mostly in the Western Cape, Northern Cape. And they now have 97 seats across the country. This has placed them in a position to be the kingmaker in many councils across the country, where they have leveraged that into becoming the de facto kingmakers. In this Karoo Central District municipality, there was a brief stint where Gayton McKenzie, the party leader, was in fact the district mayor. He very aggressively campaigned with this on social media, made a big deal about it, particularly of fixing swimming pools. That was the sort of promise of his that went the most viral. He did leave, however, after a relatively short time. The piece that the Daily Maverick wrote notes, however, that his promise of fixing swimming pools remained largely unfulfilled. In the 2024 election, the PA grew to 2.06% of the vote nationally, which is a massive increase from where they started in 2014. The party's branding is that sort of lime green, yellowish green, which does, I think, kind of stand out a bit from some of the other parties. It looks a little bit like ANC colors, but it's also got its own distinct sort of feel to it. You can usually pick it apart. One of their slogans is The Last Hope, which has a sort of apocalyptic feel to it. Since then, Gayton McKenzie has used this success to get himself placed in the GNU as the Minister of Arts and Culture, something which he seems to have had a bit of a mixed record on. The most interesting thing in this piece was just a couple of interviews, I thought, with various people who had started supporting the PA recently in George. A woman called Bronwyn Minar said that I'll vote for the PA. I see they're making change. Another woman from George, who's 48, said she grew up with the ANC. Her mother and her father were ANC, but in July last year, her house burned down. She said when the fire raged, neither the ANC representatives nor anyone from the DA or COPE came to help. The PA supported us with food and those things and clothes. I'll stand for those people. So, Terence, the PA is an increasingly important player in our politics, but the question is, firstly, what does this whole populism thing mean? Which is, I know, something you've written about before and studied a bit. And secondly, you know, what do we think the PA's prospects are for the next local government election?
I tend to be somewhat skeptical when I hear or see a headline with the word populist in it, my first question is, does this person actually know what he or she is talking about? Because I think it's a much used but poorly understood concept. Populism, the etymological root is popular as in people. It's sort of an idea, whether it's an ideology or a zeitgeist or whatever. There's debates around that, but it's the sense that this represents the kind of mass of a polity as opposed to its elites. Now, do I think that the Patriotic Alliance is a populist movement? Yes, I think that by most of the definitions that exist, absolutely. I'm not quite sure, though, that that many of the journalists who use this phrase do. Yeah, this particular article, for instance, I think the word populist is used something like 4 or 5 times, including in the title. But there's no sense of a definition or anything. It's just thrown around as like a bad thing. It's about someone wanting to be popular. I think there are two big factors that tend to circulate around the idea of populism. First of all, is this divide between the elite and the people, hence the term populist. The idea that we represent the authentic, the good people, as opposed to the guys with money and power and nefarious influences who don't share our values. I think the Patriotic Alliance kind of falls into that. I think maybe what concerns or perturbs a number of analysts and journalists is that they don't share those assumptions. And I think that sometimes blinds commentators to seeing that a lot of people actually do. The other thing is that this is not something unique to the Patriotic Alliance. I mean, I think that there's a very, very strong strain of populism that goes through the ANC. This idea that there is a Manichean division between, within society, it's the people versus the counter-revolution, or the people versus the imperialists or whatever. These are all popular sentiments in some in some respects, and I would say that one can make an argument that has been far more destructive than anything Gate and McKenzie has done. The other thing is it's the strong sense of personality. The idea that you have a leader who is directly connected with his or her constituency. I would say that, as you said, Gate and McKenzie does a lot of his politics through social media. It's a big marker of modern populists, because you're sort of avoiding the muckraking fake news media. You're speaking directly to the people. That being said, could one make an argument that someone like Nelson Mandela, embodied a very similar impulse? Turning to the question about what are their prospects, I think this in some ways is a question that attends all populist insurgencies, and I think this is something that a lot of analysts get wrong, that the fact that something is populist does not mean the issues are not real. Now, I remember one of the great populist moments, sometimes self-described, was the Brexit referendum in the United Kingdom. And I remember just watching the coverage of that and thinking, the anti-Brexit crowd must be incredibly confident that they're going to win, because they don't seem to be doing very much to try and bring, people in favor of this into their fold. It seemed to be more a matter of, you're stupid, you're racist, you're xenophobic, and when we win, we're going to rub your noses in it. Now, let me say, had I been in Britain at the time, I'd probably have voted to remain in the European Union, but there seemed to be an enormous degree of hubris. you know, what some political scientists have called the crisis of representation is a real thing, where people do not feel that their interests are adequately embodied by existing formations. So yes, in that sense, I think that this is a populist moment for South Africa. I would just add as a bit of a sting that the idea that Gayton McKenzie is appealing to coloured people, and that there's something wrong with this, I think that needs to be seen within the context of 30 years of what I would consider more or less the betrayal of the non-racial ideal, and sometimes the reification of that by elements of the commentariat. That really, you know, everything does kind of swirl around race. Well, you know, if you can do that because, you know, of critical race theory or whatever, believe me, Gayton McKenzie can come and do it on a sort of low key colored nationalism. It all becomes very very much part of the same thought system.
So one of the interesting things has been how in this particular piece, you know, populism almost seems to just stand in for anti-immigrant. And this has been one of the planks that the PA has sort of adopted. It's been much more aggressive in opposing immigration and foreigners, and this has caused controversy from time to time with, you know, Gayton McKenzie saying there's too many foreigners working for this government department or whatever. And, you know, that... So I think very often when a lot of commentators use the term populist, what they really just mean is very anti-immigrant. There's also some questions. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No. I think also there's a tendency to use populist as a stand-in for authoritarian. I think these things are distinct. While some populists are xenophobic, not all xenophobes are populist. You know, I think that, you know, we need to, I think that as a whole, our public debate could do with some more conceptual clarity. But I'm probably barking into our hurricane.
Wouldn't that be nice? There's also this sort of question of, you know, is the PA inevitably going to overtake the DA everywhere, and is it going to sort of wipe it out? And, you know, when it comes to the by-elections, you can kind of pick and choose your examples. There's cases where the PA is sort of underperformed and the DA has held on to its position, cases where the PA has taken mostly from the ANC and left the DA as the biggest party, and then other cases where the DA has really had its vote share hammered by the PA, particularly in the rural Western Cape, and it's emerged as a party. And, you know, depending on which by-election you look at, which time, it seems to, you can tell a different story there. There are some interesting things I've noticed. For example, I think it's Eldorado Park, Ward 18 and 17 in Johannesburg. In 2021, the PA got 61% in Ward 18 and 51% in Ward 17. Now, that was in the local government elections. You jump forward to the national elections, same wards, and suddenly the PA is down to 32% in Ward 18 and 31% in Ward 17, with the DA emerging back to the top. Now, this used to be one of the DA's strongest wards in the city of Joburg, because they are the mostly coloured voters. And so in the 2016 kind of period, the DA did really well there. And I do wonder whether the PA's real success is not going to be necessarily in actually taking out the DA in some places. I think they've definitely taken coloured support from the DA, particularly in some urban areas. But I do wonder whether the actual party that should be really worried about the PA is the ANC. I think it's very possible the PA could eat up a lot of ANC votes in rural areas, in the Western Cape in particular, and even emerge as one of the biggest parties in the Western Cape because of that. And part of this comes into the problem of, you know, we as analysts and stuff, we often talk about these kind of shorthands of, you know, the coloured vote, the white vote, the black vote, whatever. But that's actually not that helpful of a tool quite often. Sometimes it can be a sort of rough guideline for how things go. But, you know, these are groups that don't really exist. What it means is, yes, there are people who are self-identify as this or that, but you know, a middle class colored doctor working in Cape Town, who lives in I don't know, Kirstenbosch or something, has an extremely different lifestyle to a farm worker in the rural Western Cape, you know, kind of by Swellendam. So I don't know, Terence, you know, maybe that is kind of where to look in the next local government election. Maybe the real story is going to be how the PA destroys what's left of the ANC in the Western Cape. What's your take on that?
Quite plausible that. I think that the PA's appeal is to a disaffected constituency. So I think it might be more useful to look at it as having a class basis, rather, you know, as opposed to a purely racial basis. Yes. That being said, I do think that there is something that that is dynamic in our politics, that there is the shiny new thing that comes and goes. Remember Patricia DeLille? I remember about 20 years ago, I worked with a young colored woman who basically said, well, wherever Patricia goes, we will go. I don't think that really held on. Remember Bantu Holomisa, the UDM? Well, you know, they're still there, but much reduced presence. I suspect that we are in a period of political turmoil, so people are maybe more inclined to try new things out. But I don't. But whether they'll be held in any particular loyalty, that's a big open question. It remains to be seen. I'm not discounting it. I do think one of the issues that the Patriotic Alliance is going to have to contend with is just that I think it is a very heavily personality driven party. Now, Gayton McKenzie's, you know, is relatively young and robust, so I don't think that's an imminent danger. But should he disengage? Does it have legs? Does it have a kind of brand that can endure? The ANC had one. It's taken a number of leaders to like drag that brand through the mud. The DA has a brand that has you know, been able to keep it at that 20% mark. Patriotic Alliance, I think the lack at the moment, at least, of that sort of a sort of strong and durable brand is something that is that will work against it.
Yeah, I think it's also going to be interesting to see, you know, in the places where the PA has established itself in government, does it strengthen or does it weaken? And how does, I'm sure it's going to certainly win a kingmaker position in a number of municipalities across the country in the next local government election. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, where the party strategically places itself. Right, it initially had this alliance with the DA in a bunch of municipalities, and that fell through. And so since then, it's tended to form more coalitions with the ANC. As the ANC seems to, you know, be in increasing trouble, I wonder whether the PM may switch back again to looking for alliances with other parties. Before we move on, any thoughts on that?
No, I think you're quite correct. And as I say, a party that is very much built around a particular personality can be very unpredictable.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to our next story. There's a Business Day interview with Jordan Hill Lewis, who is very likely to be the next leader of the DA, with the headline, "Hill Lewis signals pragmatic DA position on BEE amid leadership bid." Now, as big opponents of BEE, we are this sort of caught our attention and we immediately looked at it. And the piece sort of implies that the language between the ANC and the DA is converging on reform, and that there is that Hill Lewis is suggesting some sort of climb down on the DA's position on BEE, making the point that It says here, quote, Hill Lewis is also candid about the constraints coalition politics impose, saying no party can expect to implement its full program unless it's an outright majority. And then it quotes him directly. If no one wins an election outright, no one gets to implement their full program of action. That really reality means the DA and ANC will need to identify areas of policy overlap while setting aside politically irreconcilable proposals. Hill Lewis did also say, in sort of contrast to all of that, that the DA must remain visibly distinct in the coalition. It's not simply good enough to be there. You must be there to make an impact, and that impact must be clear. Now, recently, Hill Lewis did also quite explicitly reject the racial criteria in BEE in a radio interview where he talked about how it was that just because the DA was against race-based empowerment doesn't mean that they didn't believe that Black South Africans shouldn't receive empowerment. They basically said that, you know, if it's a means-tested, he basically said if it's a means-tested approach, the vast majority of people who would benefit from any empowerment strategy would, in fact, be Black, because most poor people in South Africa are Black. So I think, firstly, I'm not sure if the headline is correct here, saying that he is, you know, adapting pragmatism per se on this topic. You know, we'll see what he says in the next few weeks. But I'm pretty sure that he hasn't suddenly decided that BE is okay. But it is an interesting question. It's very likely that no political party, at least for a long time, is going to have a coalition, a majority in our elections, perhaps never again. Our electoral system is very strongly in favor of allowing power to splinter between various parties and to form coalitions because of our proportional system. So that means we're in a position where, you know, if the DA and the ANC are the only parties who can form some sort of government in 2029, you know, what are we going to see? Are we going to see the GNU again? What if the DA is the biggest party rather than the ANC, but they still need each other? How do you walk this sort of bridge between these parties that are on completely different axes to each other? And should we just lower our expectations for the amount of change we expect to see from our politics? What's your take on this whole story, Terence?
Well, in a way, you know, I have a more generous view of what he was saying. I think that it's not so much, he wasn't articulating a normative a position so much as the inevitable consequences of being in a coalition arrangement. You know, you have to find something on that people can at least all live with. Now, we would obviously say get rid of BE entirely. The ANC, you know, has made clear that's non-negotiable. Not to a large extent, that's because they're a nationalist party, you know, and they would, as a general rule, they would probably be willing to accept the economic damage if they knew the benefits were going to particular to a particular group, or you know, being a party that believes that the party itself must be in a must be in the absolute driving seat, that those benefits accrue to those associated with the with the party. So this is a matter of real politic. You know, we probably don't get a real shot at getting rid of this for the next 10 years, but maybe we can soften some of the edges. Maybe we can make some adjustments so that it is not as malevolently ruinous as it is now. You know, that I think is also both the benefit and the curse of a constitutional democracy. One thing, incidentally, populists don't like, it is simply that there are restraints and there are limits to what you can do, both constitutional and political. If you are an absolute monarch, you can say, you know, off with his head, or, you know, tariffs. Yeah, okay, maybe that's not the best example, but you get where I'm going. So, Yes, you know, I think that while this is not a message that we may or want to hear, I do think it's a message that we, in a sense, need to hear.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because you're going to have these, you know, with our politics becoming ever more competitive, I think it's going to very much, you know, the debates on convincing the public on certain issues are going to be far more important. You won't just need to convince the leaders of political parties, as has been the case up till now.
Sure.
But you're going to really have to convince the public to create pressure from below to change things. And I think the debate on BE is one where the public is shifting and can be shifted further to pressure even a party like the ANC into needing to abandon it.
Yeah.
Or face total electoral oblivion.
Yeah. And that's the role of the of a group like the IRR. I must say I wake up every morning and say, fortunately, I'm not responsible for the water supply to Johannesburg. I can, however, get ideas about how to sort it out. But you know, maybe that also makes me a bit of a coward.
Yeah. No, I also am glad I don't have to fix the water supply to Johannesburg. Yeah, so interesting stuff, and I look forward to seeing more of what comes out of Hill Lewis's sort of campaign for leader. Still staying on the DA, Agriculture Minister and outgoing DA leader John Steenhuisen is getting into an increasingly bitter fight with a number of groups representing some farmers in the country. Particularly the South African Agri Initiative, SAI, John Steenhuisen has accused of exploiting the country's foot and mouth disease crisis to sow division in the sector. Theo Diaga from SAI said that he was that he had questions about the government's procurement. He said, quote, the real price of both the Biogenesis Bago and Dolvet vaccines is around 45 rand per shot. That is what farmers would have paid if the state didn't grab the vaccine. So where do the profits go? And he's also questioned the requirements that the state be the one administering the vaccines to various cattle and livestock. Steenhuisen has very aggressively responded to this, saying that he rejects allegations from Sai and Tiago, and accuses them of spreading misinformation. Steenhuisen said, quote, he takes the unit price, but then conveniently excludes the freight, delivery taxes, clearing and distribution charges that any importer would have to pay. The government is sourcing vaccines at the best available price and is paying for distributing them in line with our strategy. Fake news does not assist in combating a disease outbreak. He said that foot and mouth disease is a controlled disease that required a coordinated national response. Quote, it's absolute nonsense. I mean, right from the beginning, we've said this is a state-controlled disease. We have imported those vaccines to roll them out for a state response, and that's what we're currently doing. I don't understand what he's expecting. To roll out the national vaccination campaign, we've committed to and repeatedly outlined on several public platforms, we intend to vaccinate 80% of the national herd by December, and that's what we're doing. We're rolling out vaccines around the country, and there are hundreds of thousands of animals being vaccinated every week. He said, I'm very concerned amid the crisis. The last thing you need is disunity in the sector. We should all pull in the same direction. It seems that SAI's agenda is to try and disrupt and sow division as much as possible. All that's going to do is make our fight against foot and mouth disease a lot harder. It's absurd. No one's making a profit here. We're bringing in vaccines as cheaply as we can. He also implied that SAI was doing this to essentially get donor support and that sort of thing. So, Terence, what do you make of all this? It's getting quite charged and nasty.
It's been said that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, and I would say unity is the last desperate call of a desperate person. I think that this is something that I've seen since the 1990s. No, we mustn't politicize crime. You know, we must work together. We must have unity. You know, we shouldn't argue about foreign policy. We must, you know, support a South African position, et cetera, et cetera. The point is that democracy doesn't work like that. And no one, no one should should well, if anyone should know this, it's the Democratic Alliance, because they were often called upon to, you know, show that wonderful unity and be constructive and whatever, and they, you know, they did what they did. My own sense is that this is a, if you want to take the sort of narrowest version, this catastrophe has been going on for about a year, maybe a little bit less. But the problem goes back to about 2019. Why has it taken, you know, this length of time to actually get these vaccines in? You know, if there was no such thing as Psy, or there was no such person as pardon me, I think I'm the second person to sneeze on this show, and I was also the first. And if there was no such person as Theo de Jager, we would still have this problem. Farmers I've spoken to are viscerally angry about the way it's been handled. As far as the administration, you know, what a number of them have said is that they already can do their own vaccinations for a great many conditions that are also, you know, sort of equivalent seriousness. I think, you know, and I don't believe that anyone, not, you know, not even Theo de Jager, has said that any kind of medicine should be brought in without any controls. The problem is the government is trying to monopolize every kind of step along the journey. And if I can say so, I think it effectively needs to eat what it has cooked. Now, I do have some sympathy for Minister Stiernhuizen. He inherited this problem, but that doesn't excuse him from being the guy who's sitting in the hot seat.
So, one of the arguments that's been put forward by why the state needs to have control over this is, if I can sort of paraphrase it in my crude non-expert terms, that you need a sort of you're kind of trying to create barriers and lay out sort of a vaccination strategy which, you know, prioritizes certain areas above others and ensures that you've got the correct vaccines, and that essentially you can kind of fight the disease almost like a general. And that's why the state sort of needs to maintain control of this whole thing. What do you make of that argument? And
Well, up to a point, I see the logic, and up to a point that would hold water. But the ability to do that sort of military style operation where you cordon the area off, that went out the window, you know, as this thing started to spread. If you look at previous outbreaks, like in Camperdown, I think it was about 2000 or 2002, that was what they were able to do. When it is effectively a nationwide problem, you know, the idea that you're going to, you know, prioritize certain areas, I don't see it as being quite as compelling an argument. And The other thing, in a sense, what I consider the smoking gun, and I've actually approached the ministry for comment and it was never forthcoming, why did it take them so long to submit samples of this to the Purbright Institute in the UK? Because they identify the exact strain, what is available, and what is optimal for combating that. Yet they only did that, I think, in November last year. Minister Stiernhuizen said on carte blanche, well, it wouldn't have helped us because, you know, they couldn't have really given us anything that we didn't really know and that we couldn't do ourselves. Then when the samples went, it was, this is a step change and game changer in fighting this disease. Now, it seems to me that was just, you know, a baseline obvious thing to do. And if there were difficulties getting that done, that shows the scale of the problem.
Something to keep an eye on, I think, going forward. We are out of time, however, for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.